LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guests today are John Bunzel and Nick Duffel, who join us to discuss their book, The Simpol Solution. Although both parts of this interview may be taken on their own, it is strongly recommended that you listen to both. Energy crisis, fossil fuel depletion, wealth inequality, mass migration, economic collapse, environmental disaster, political instability, nuclear proliferation, terrorism. Why are governments and major international organizations so hopelessly unable to solve our mounting global problems? The truth is that in an age of globalization, free-flowing capital, and banking without borders, government hands are effectively tied. Regulations or other schemes which might rein in the worst excesses of business and industry are rarely enacted or even considered simply because they would lead to cuts in corporate profits. Taken with the fact that governments in general are adept at drafting bad legislation, often operate a revolving door policy with business in terms of recruitment, and are themselves hardly paragons of best practice when it comes to energy, economy, environment, or any other stress point you can name, we face an apparently intractable situation. Some think the answers lie in global government and big thinking, others in localism and small-scale solutions. But while both are generally designed to sidestep bureaucratic gridlock, for many they smack of communism, fascism, or some other ism in which a largely unelected elite dictate the rules to everyone else. Through the lens of conventional politics, of whatever colour, it seems that we can have either unity or diversity, but not both. In the meantime, of course, our predicament continues to get worse, and as we look extinction in the eye yet again, we wonder once more, is there really no alternative? Hello and welcome, John. Nick, thank you both for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Nice to be back.
Okay, guys, now today we're going to be talking about a book called The Simpol Solution, which both of you have put together. In my introduction, I've set out basically what this is, so that's fine. So people already somewhat up to speed on the essentials. Before we get into that, if you could each just tell the listeners a little bit about your background and your work in general.
My background is a business background, family business, which I've been in since about 1978. It's a raw materials trading business mostly, although we've done a few other things. So that's been my background all the way. The simple idea basically occurred to me in about the end of 1998. And since then, I've kind of led a double life. One side of it's been business, the other side of it's been simple.
Okay, John, well, you mentioned simple coming along at the end of the 90s. Just tell us about the evolution of that, how that came up, and, you know, your involvement, just how all that took shape. And no, it may just be because I've been looking in the wrong places, but establishing it in 2000, and I've only heard of it since the publication of this book, which has just come out. So maybe you could just tell us, you know, what the developments have been in that interim period, you know, what's been happening in the meantime.
Sure. I haven't really had any particular interest in world affairs or even in politics. When the idea kind of struck me, but it really came to me in a kind of light bulb moment over a Sunday lunch with my family, and my kids were talking about climate change, because I think they were covering it at school. And, you know, as I was sort of just doing the washing up afterwards, I think my mum sort of turned around and sort of said, well, what would you do about it? Which is, you know, nice question to get. And I just thought about it for a moment, and I think this is where my business background comes in. I just realized, well, you know, it would have to happen simultaneously. It would have to happen with all nations moving together on the same date, because otherwise any nation that tried to move first would land up with a disadvantage, an economic competitive disadvantage. And so it sort of went from there. And I wrote an earlier book, and I started sort of gradually getting a campaign together. But the reason you probably haven't heard of it, Greg, is because I don't think sounds a bit cliche, but I don't think people are ready for it yet, or that people are getting readier for it. But originally, when I started with it, I thought, oh, you know, I'm a businessman. I don't know anything about campaigning. I'll go and present this to Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and these kind of organizations that know about campaigning, and they'll take it on and do the job. But what I found was that they weren't particularly interested in it. And I didn't really understand why until much later, when I started reading Claire Graves and Ken Wilber and started learning about levels of consciousness. And so I had to really sort of start the campaign myself and with some others, and we've been plugging away at it sort of very quietly in the background, gradually building it up more and more and more. But even today, it's still relatively unknown.
Well, why there might be resistance to this concept from those who you might expect to be most interested, we'll get to that again in a little bit. But let's kind of go back to basics with the underlying issue here, which is competition. And there's lots of, you know, on either end of the political spectrum, and indeed right the way along it, there's lots of strong opinion about competition being a good thing, a bad thing. Clearly, on one level, it's kind of neutral, in that, you know, in some instances it's a boon, in some it's to the detriment of all of us. But the overarching concept here is that you've identified as this destructive global competition. This is something quite specific. And so perhaps we just need to explain to people, you know, about that, because that, of course, runs all the way through the book.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what you just said earlier, Greg, is exactly right. People haven't really worked out clearly in their minds that competition can be either constructive or destructive. It is not just one or just the other. It depends on the circumstances. And indeed, cooperation can actually also be constructive or destructive. And one can think of our, you know, different examples in each of those four categories. But I think the point about the book is that today, We are generally told under neoliberal orthodox economic doctrine that, you know, competition is a good thing. You know, if there's a problem, well, we need to privatize it and bring in competition, and you know, that will bring in more efficiency. It will make prices cheaper. It will provide more choice. And so we are inculcated with just one side of competition. And what the book really highlights is the shadow side. It's the destructive side of competition. And that's really what we focus on. You know, it's not wrong. The orthodox economists are not wrong that competition can bring benefits and lower prices and more efficiency in certain circumstances. But what we're trying to highlight in the book is that the really big problems that we're facing in the world, such as climate change, such as wealth inequality, such as mass migration, corporate power, the rich and the corporations not paying fair taxes, these are all exacerbated by destructive competition. And that is destructive competition between governments, And that means that no government can actually mitigate or solve those problems, because to do that ultimately means increasing business taxes, or it means increasing taxes on the rich. But any government that does that on its own will only see those entities move elsewhere. Corporations will move business or jobs or investment elsewhere. The rich will just migrate elsewhere. And then, of course, some other country will gain the benefit of the tax revenue. So governments are, I mean, I suppose the way to explain it would be to say, you just imagine a football field that doesn't have one referee, but it's divided up into about 200 squares, with each square having its own referee, like 200 different countries, its own government. And the only way that the referee can get the players to come and play in its square is by making it the cost of playing the game cheaper in its square, which means cutting taxes for the rich, making it attractive for corporations to invest. And so you can easily visualize what's going to happen. It's going to be either a race to the bottom, or it's going to mean that regulation on things like climate change is what we call chill. It's called regulatory chill. It means that regulations might be actually not racing to the bottom, but they're not actually increasing fast enough to deal with the problem. So those are the two aspects of destructive competition: the race to the bottom thing, which most people are quite familiar with, but almost the more insidious one is this regulatory chill, where governments just can't regulate problems, regulate to sort out problems adequately enough, because they fear competition, they fear that business and jobs will move elsewhere. And so, of course, the problems just keep getting worse.
And we hear a lot these days about, the sort of mobility of capital, because, these days you're not even moving money. It's not like a century's gone by when you have to load up a chest full of gold and haul it around the place. It's just, a few keystrokes and suddenly your billions aren't in London anymore. They're in Singapore or whatever it happens to be. And that's
It's even worse than that, Greg, because just the mere knowledge of governments that businesses and the rich have the ability to press those keys on their keyboard is enough.
And of course, we've seen with businesses that do have buildings, infrastructure, employees, Amazon, Starbucks, we've heard news stories about those in recent times, about them sort of having nominal headquarters in places. So when Starbucks can't just up and move all their stores out of a country, but they can shift where they're paying their taxes with a few, a bit of sleight of hand, and there's tax evasion versus tax avoidance. Some of it's legal, some of it's not. But the point is, it's more mobility, this sort of fleet of foot that governments don't have and that populations tend not to have, makes it much easier to bend the rules and even break them.
Yeah, that's right. So this is in a sense where you get the widening gap between rich and poor, because effectively what you've just described, Greg, means that any entity that is globally mobile and can therefore shift its resources, across national borders, or can play one government off against another, will win at the expense of any entity that is nationally rooted, such as national governments, such as the middle classes and the poor, who don't have the ability to move their resources around so easily. So it's very easy to see, why, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. It's not complicated.
And with the global kind of business situation, it's kind of like, no matter how good competition is in some ways for a while, that the benefits can't cut off at some point. That just gets to a point where actually you're getting not just diminishing returns, but it's actually causing major problems in other parts of the system. But this, you've got this imperative that you've described with the regulatory chill, money being moved around, chasing this race to the bottom, which you also described. But even when there's disbenefits piling up, because some people, the people in control, are still gaining, the incentive is, even though it dooms the whole system to collapse, and even those who are benefiting ultimately right at the top, that's not got a future either, but it's still this bizarre imperative. It's almost like we've unleashed something that's just almost beyond human control. Of course it's not, but it seems that way doesn't it? I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Corporation, but when you watch when you watch that, you very much see how we can put together an entity on paper or even bricks and mortar, whatever, you know, give it a name and off it goes. And I remember when Enron blew up, that whole scandal, and everyone talked about, oh, Enron this and Enron that. But yeah, but people made those decisions. And that was the other problem with the banking crisis, wasn't it? It was like, oh, you know, Royal Bank of Scotland did this and Deutsche Bank did that. But hang on, who did it? These people never seem to be named.
No, that's right. I mean, this is one of the slightly tricky areas of the argument. And that is where does individual responsibility start and finish? And where does the systemic kind of herd mentality take over? You know, I mean, for example, if you take Enron, you very clearly had some very crooked people doing some very crooked stuff, and they should be punished, and they should have been punished for it. But what I think is actually more prevalent is the systemic, and by that what I mean is not to excuse corporations, if you like, but what I'm trying to point out is that, you know, if Apple or Starbucks or Amazon, if they don't avoid tax by shifting their operations to the lowest tax country, their competitors will. And so, you know, what I'm trying to highlight is the systemic nature. It's almost not that these people are evil people. They're just trying to stay in business, and they damn well know that if they don't take advantage of the lowest tax jurisdictions and their competitors do, they're going to lose out and their share price will go down and so forth. So I think what Nick and I are trying to highlight with the book and highlight with this concept of destructive global competition being a vicious circle is that while individual responsibility and individual actions are, you know, need to be taken seriously, there is a very powerful systemic driver for this, which actually leaves business people often with very little choice.
Well, this is where the cooperation thing comes in. I think that, you know, cooperation is essential to our survival. Certainly, if we go back deep into the history of the species, that we wouldn't really have got anything done. If it was everyone against everyone all the time, we wouldn't be here right now having Absolutely. This conversation. An example I sometimes give that everyone can identify with, if they're talking about, you know, if someone says, well, competition, you know, it's just, it's an unalloyed good, really, you know, because it forces people, it encourages people to do the best they can, the best value, the best quality, and to keep innovating. And that's, yeah, the whole point is that's up to a certain point. I then give the example of the family. And it's like, if you had a competitive element within your family, I don't know, you know, maybe a couple of your kids, you've got a couple of boys and they both love sports and they're always trying to outdo each other and, you know, get more medals, you know, and that's all a bit of fun, you know, and they just like to challenge each other a little bit. And you could think of all sorts of other situations in a family where it might be a little bit competitive, you know, who's going to make the best spaghetti bolognese or whatever. But would you actually say to your kids or other family members, you know, we have limited resources in the family. We're going to compete for them. There will be winners. There will be losers. I'm sorry about that.
yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole point, and the family is a good example, Greg. The whole point about coming back to what we were talking about destructive and constructive competition is that there's a paradox, and the paradox is that competition will tend to be constructive if it is held within a cooperative cradle of rules and limits. So, for example, you might take a tennis match or a football game. You know, it's obviously a competition between the two sides. However, there is a cooperative framework of rules around that. There's the referee, there's the line judges, there's the lines on the pitch, the size of the goal, there's the rule book, there's the FA. And all of, and mind you, football probably isn't a great example of this, Greg, is it? With FIFA and all of that lot, but you know that's another example. But you know, my point is that the competition will tend to be constructive if it's held within a cooperative framework of rules. If that cooperative framework breaks down, the competition will, you know, tend to morph into destructive shadow side, is then if the rules are not enforced properly, you know, the players will start to find ways of cheating. And it just gets worse. And if one gets away with it, the others have to follow, which is a little bit like what I was talking about, the tax avoidance thing.
Okay, well, I mentioned a moment ago, you know, this idea about in the deep history of the human race, about how cooperation would have got us from our very early developmental stages. And of course, there would have been conflicts and competition, power struggles within the race, whatever. But cooperation was a large part of it, especially in a survival situation. But for the longest time, probably millennia now, we can think of competition for resources or businesses running, even as that we might recognize now, that might have been running thousands of years ago, people buying and selling things, manufacturing things, goods and services. This sort of exchange economy seems to be a sort of natural human condition, really, or certainly has evolved to be that or grown to be that. However, it's something we've lived with for a long time. For some people, the answer to a lot of problems along the lines that we've been talking about is to have more competition, you know, more of the same, basically. We're just not doing it good enough. That's the problem, you know. We think we've got a free market economy, but it's not quite free enough. However, what's kind of perhaps not unique about our time, but we've got converging crises right now, which is why that you've popped up with this concept and you're trying to get people interested in it, get people thinking about it, trying to change the direction we're going in, because the modern industrial society is quite unlike, in some respects, all those that have gone before. So you mentioned environment before, problems we have there. We have an economic system globally that's, and a lot of systems, that's the whole point. They've never been more intermeshed. They are now global systems, and you know, national governments are struggling to respond to the problems with them. We have energy situation going on at the minute. You know, we're coming up increasingly against problems providing enough energy to keep all of this cascading system going. So it's against this background, really, that you're saying, hey, look, we have to start thinking about this differently. So that's why if you, or perhaps your earlier incarnation 1,000 years ago, probably these ideas wouldn't have been seen as particularly relevant, because resources, well, everything else just seems so much more abundant.
Well, I'm not so sure, Greg, actually. I mean, I know where you're going with this, but I think at every stage of human history, we had the same problems, but on a different scale. So one can imagine that you know, back in the sort of days of prehistory, you know, you might have had a small tribe in one valley that never really spoke to or even knew that one in the next valley existed, until they started to compete or meet with one another, and then they maybe got on or they maybe didn't. But when a third tribe came over the hill, they thought, shit, we better get together and cooperate to fight off this third party. You know, so, or it may have been polluting a river, you know, upstream, and then the pollution goes downstream, and then the people who have to suffer the pollution downstream sort of come upstream, and they have to start interacting and trying to solve it together. You know, so I think all these, the kind of problems we're seeing today are not ultimately new. They are just, you know, the today's bigger versions. That's all. And indeed, I think the reason that these problems are not new is that's why human social units have progressed over the course of evolution, have progressively increased in size. You know, we've gone from families to bigger tribes to city states to middle-aged small states to still larger nation states. And now the problems are surpassing nation states. So that's why we now need to be talking about global cooperation. So what you're talking about, I would say, has sort of been happening since time immemorial, but the scale, we're now at the global level, whereas, you know, in prior times we'd been at, you know, family or tribal or city level. Now we're at the global level.
Okay, I guess what I was thinking of was just that the scale in itself was a problem now, perhaps unlike that which we'd faced before, because some of the threats or potential threats would be on a global scale, and that could that could pose problems of survivability, or even of like the civilization that we have continuing in its current form, if you see what I mean. So
yeah,
that was the thrust of my point, I think, was just that.
You're quite right. Yeah, that's right. You know, you're absolutely right. I just wanted to sort of point out that this isn't, you know, that this has sort of been going on since time immemorial, but right now the problems are, as you say, they are bigger than ever before, and they're global.
Well, with Nick, we can get into some of the reasons about, you know, human psychology and these problems that have been around since forever. You know, what human development, human evolution of the brain, of consciousness, and how that might have affected our behavior over the longest period of time. But just staying on a contemporary note, I think growth is a tremendous problem here, because the economic system that we have globally demands exponential growth, and of course that's impossible on a finite planet. So that's one of the drivers, I think, also in the system. It's one of the factors that's there, is that everything has to keep getting bigger. And not, I'm just talking about population here, but that's one function of it. So that is one of the drivers, one of the definite aggravating factors, because in order to bring all of this under control, I think that you're having, and a lot of other people who are not necessarily aware of the simple idea, are thinking we have to get this under control. We can't just keep consuming more and having ever more debt, ever more energy consumption, ever more resource consumption. You know, whatever this is going to, we're going to have to at least bring this to a halt. We're going to have to stabilize this somehow. So,
absolutely. I totally agree, Greg. And what I think we are trying to say with the simple solution is that yes, you know, growth, I mean, you cannot have unending growth on a finite planet. However, if you're going to regulate growth in some way, or you're going to restrain bad growth and maybe allow good growth, or if you're going to, you know, whatever you want to do, you're going to have to do it globally. You're going to have to do it through cooperation. So my suggestion would be that, you know, growth is it may be a problem, but the real problem is the lack of cooperation. Because if you want to deal with growth, you've got to get cooperation first. No cooperation, and you won't get any control over growth.
Okay, well, we've used the word global a few times, so let's just address that, the elephant in the room for a lot of people, which is this idea about, oh, here we go, global means global institutions. We've already got a bunch of those. They're either impotent, or they're malign, or, you know, they're sort of, they hoover up money themselves and don't really seem to do very much. People thinking about, you know, IMF, World Bank, United Nations, you name it. Other people that I've heard talking on these subjects just think, oh no, can you imagine a global technocracy of faceless bureaucrats? You know, the EU just writ large on a global scale, it would be a nightmare. So yeah, People's negative ideas about global organizations, or about the idea of a global government kind of telling everyone what to do, you do address that in the book. You say this is not what we're talking about here. And in fact, there's a very illuminating thread running throughout the book where you say, well, although localism, which a lot of people are talking about at the minute, isn't the answer to this as such, that some global levels of cooperation could reignite the good aspects of localism, you know, localism where it's appropriate, and indeed that national identity, we're not talking about nationalism here, but national identity in terms of culture and history, that isn't going to be erased by any of this. It can actually be reinforced and kind of brought back to life in some ways.
Exactly, Greg, and actually, it's, you know, this is a critical point. For example, let me just mention E.F. Schumacher, who wrote "Small is Beautiful," and who's sort of regarded as one of the, I suppose, the fathers of the environmental movement. And in fact, "Small is Beautiful" was not his chosen title for that book. It was actually that title was given to the book by his publisher. But as a result of that, I think a lot of the environmental movement think that everything's got to be small now, and therefore everything global is bad. But actually, Fritz Schumacher was actually talking about appropriate scale. And as you'll know in the book, we quote him where he says, something like, just paraphrasing it now, we need the freedom and autonomy of lots and lots of small units, but at the same time, the orderliness and the orderliness of large-scale, possibly global unity and coordination. In other words, what he's talking about is that the way you get healthy smallness is sort of within a cooperative bigness. It's a little bit like we were talking about the tennis match. If you want healthy competition, you've got to have it within a larger cooperative framework. And it's this duality, and it's holding the global and the local together in one's mind and not privileging one or the other. And that's what people, I think, find difficult. But that is what we are talking about with this impulse solution. And we're not talking about a world government. We are talking about coordinated, simultaneous action between the existing nation states that we have in the world today, and how we as citizens can actually drive our politicians, at least in the West, towards that more cooperative framework through which and only through which we will solve things like growth, like climate change, like wealth inequality, mass migration, and so forth. And only through that kind of coordination will you be able to have, for example, transnational redistributions of wealth, where we can start taxing these multinationals and redistributing some of the wealth to poorer countries, so that people can make a decent living at home and they won't feel the need to migrate in the masses that they're migrating today. So, you know, it's actually, rather, as opposed to multiculturalism, what we're talking about is simulculturalism. It's about a global coordination that supports every culture on its own terms and at its current level of development through an economic system that is genuinely fair and equitable to all, which I know sounds, even when I hear myself say that, I recognize that it sounds sort of slightly utopian. But what I'm trying to say to people is that if you have a global economy, as we already do, you cannot hope to make it just or sustainable without some kind of global cooperative government.
Yeah, you mentioned migration there and multiculturalism. And I think that that's one of several kind of problem areas that we see very much in the news at the minute that I think are addressed or certainly can be seen through a very different coloured lens when you take it from the simple angle. You know, things, there's kind of a few light bulb moments there. It's like, oh, okay, right, you know. And I think that the multiculturalism that a lot of people are resistant to is basically, it's being sold to people as kind of, it's a way of trying to deal with mass migration. So the mass migration is resulting from some of these, this destructive global competition. Essentially, that's one of the nasty side effects, you know, people feeling that they've got no option left where they are, you know.
That's right.
So they've got to go somewhere else. Who can blame them? You know, they need to survive. They want some sort of life for themselves and their families. And when they end up where they're going, so a lot of them do, anybody who has, now, of course, there's some, you know, small-minded, ill-thought-through criticisms of this, but there's some perfectly reasoned ones. We saw this, you know, we see this all the time, perfectly reasonable, informed people saying, well, I'm sorry, actually there are some problems with this. But a lot of the debate around that, people try to shut it down by saying, well, it's multiculturalism, what isn't to like about that? You know, people from other parts of the world coming together, we can all live together in peace, can't we? Why have you got a problem with that? But any of the issues around that do tend to not only be understood, but you can see, as I mentioned earlier, you can see how we can work our way through this if we take a different approach to it. And the same can be said for the impotence of government, which a lot of people are very frustrated with at the minute. You know, why can't our government make a decision? Why can't we get a clear government, you know, a government with leadership and a clear agenda, know what they're doing, yeah, and get things done? The same with growing inequality, which a lot of people are frustrated about. Another side effect of this destructive global competition, the way I sum that up, is when Walmart employees can no longer afford to shop at Walmart. That type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
You see a lot.
Yes, I'm laughing, but it's actually incredibly sad. It's a good example. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we have a win-lose global economy where the globally mobile win and the nationally rooted lose. And ultimately, the only way you will solve that and all the negative fallout that you just described that comes from that is through some kind of cooperative global governance along the lines of Simpol or something similar, I would say.
So we've seen a number of movements come up recent times, you know, the last couple of decades, activist groups trying to do something about some of these problems. One of the most recent, of course, was the Occupy movement that you mentioned in the book. But they seem to kind of just fizzle out. And a lot of these mass action revolutionary movements seem to have their moment and they've arrived and it's like the time has come for this. And yet it just, whatever momentum they have, it just seems to either fizzle out or be stamped out. You know, we saw the violent put down of some of the Occupy protests. And what you're advocating, we've already addressed the idea that we're not talking about global government here. Implementing these ideas does not require revolution. It doesn't require rioting in the streets. It doesn't require people attacking the halls of power with flaming torches and pitchforks, nothing like that. It doesn't even require most people on the planet to actually do anything in the first instance. So all these things that people get very cynical about, oh, well, you know, we can protest, we can sign all the petitions we want, nothing ever changes. We're not looking to get, you know, every household to sort of fill in their form saying we're signing up for this. Now, of course, you talk about the voting system in the book and how that has incredible power. But the point being, the essential point here is that for those who have lost any faith in sort of power of the people, we're not all required to take to the streets here.
No, I mean, this is the point. I mean, the reason that Occupy and in fact the whole global justice movement has not really made any significant dent in the neoliberal juggernaut is because it has not found a way of using people's right to vote. It hasn't found a way of interfacing powerfully with the electoral system. And that is the unique selling proposition of Simpol. We have found a way of interfacing with the electoral system, which is very powerful and which politicians really can't refuse. And we've actually proved that in a small way in some of the elections that we've been active in up to now. The problem with protest and Occupy is it seeks to go around the political system. It seeks to oppose the system by through protest, through lobbying, through, you know, anything other than using the vote. And of course, as soon as you say that, people will think, oh, well, Simpol must be some new political party. No, it isn't. It is not a political party, and yet it uses the vote in a very powerful way, which I guess to someone listening to this, Greg, will sound like complete gobbledygook, but this is the point. You've got, you know, if you want to get your head around Simpol, you've got to start dealing with some paradoxes and some new thinking.
Yeah, we have tremendous voter apathy at the moment as well, which is, there's all sorts of reasons why people don't vote or they've stopped.
Absolutely. And that too is as we explain in the book, is a function of destructive global competition. Because, you know, any government, whoever you vote into power has to keep the nation internationally competitive. And that effectively means that every government, you know, whether it's red, blue, green or yellow, doesn't matter what party, is restricted to a very narrow sort of center-right market and business-friendly policy straitjacket. And so it's not surprising there's voter apathy because people are thinking, well, you know, what's the point in voting? Because whoever we vote in, they all do the same thing. You know, that's why you've got voter apathy. And of course, as a result of that, then people then, you know, don't get more extreme.
Now, we've got limited time here. So going into the mechanics of how all of this might actually begin to come to be is probably beyond the remit that, you know, of time that we do have. People can get the book, visit the website. They can find out really, you know, how you envision that this could, you know, okay, well, how would this actually work in the real world? That is set out, you know, mechanisms, you know, plans, ideas, suggestions about how this could be done. and it is doable. We've addressed the popular objection of like, well, global organizations have so far proved divisive or even destructive in their own way. Global government, lots of people object to the idea of this overarching technocracy ruling all. Another one that comes up is how you deal with, and just you can address this just as an umbrella problem, how you deal with failed states, you know, for example, North Korea, how are they going to be brought to the table in any of this? How you deal with where religion and ideology come into play, and they seem to trump the sort of logical, sensible, self-evident, some, you know, ideas that you're putting forward. It's like, you know, where religion and ideology become more important than sort of day-to-day reality. And then there's the irrational hatred, which is also linked to both those previous points, or some sort of age-old enmity. You know, would you really have Israel and the Arab states coming together to discuss some of these issues when they've got, with all the baggage they bring to the table? What would you generally say to people, you know, briefly, how all of that would be taken into account?
I mean, the simple proposal will sound incredibly naive to people if you just lay it out in a very short form. But it only really makes sense, I think, if one looks at it against, you know, against a more evolutionary backdrop, against the backdrop of a world gradually sinking under climate change, under all of these kind of problems that we are already seeing now. But if you imagine them getting worse and worse and worse, because the whole point about things getting worse is that, you know, that's the driver for cooperation. When the water gets up around people's necks, that's when old enemies suddenly realize they're better off cooperating, otherwise they're going to both go under. So I think what we're talking about is a phased process, Greg. The way that Simpol suggests that people can use their votes in this rather novel way to drive politicians towards cooperation, that can start to happen and is already starting to happen in Western countries, particularly in the UK, in Ireland, and in one or two other countries in the Western world. So you can see it starting in democratic countries. I think if you build up a head of steam there and it gradually starts to get taken up by political parties and governments, you know, you can start seeing it spreading out to many other countries. And then, you know, you will then eventually, you know, with the water level getting up around everyone's necks, the pressure for that cooperation, I think, is going to start to take off. And countries who today we think might never, ever participate in a thing like this might actually start to surprise us, because the desperate need for cooperation is so, the pressure is so high that, you know, they're going to change their minds because it becomes in their interests to cooperate. Now, I'm not saying you'll get every nation. You might not get North Korea. You might not get a few, you know, rogue states. But then the vast majority can then devise regulations to isolate them so that they can't undermine the agreement that the rest of the world wants to put in place. At the limit, I'm not even saying that this will work. What I'm saying is that if we don't try and do something like this, we've definitely got no chance. I also think that if you look at, you mentioned the Arab-Israeli conflict, if we look as a comparison that say the Northern Ireland troubles, they started to get solved when both Britain and Ireland became members of the European Union. In other words, when a more comprehensive framework started to be thrown around Northern Ireland, and the bigger parties started cooperating in a bigger framework of the EU, that kind of filtered down to Belfast and Northern Ireland, and you gradually had the surrounding mood music, if you like, which then created the conditions where cooperation and peace was more likely. So I think it's in that vein that I would like people to see the Simpol proposal. You know, we're not saying, oh, this will happen. We're saying this is a way of creating the mood music, which makes it much, much, much more likely that these kind of problems can be solved.
Well, I think certainly the issue in Northern Ireland, if just speaking from experience, is that after the modern troubles anyway, after a couple of generations or maybe a third generation came along being born into that background, people were just sick of it. They just absolutely had enough. And if you make an analogy between political violence and destructive global competition, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, it's not our natural state. You know, we're not, it's like fight or flight. It has its purpose. We're not meant to experience that 24/7. We can't cope with that. At some point, people just say enough.
That's exactly it. And that's part of what I'm talking about the, you know, the water level getting up around our necks. It's like, you know, not only does it get around our necks, we just get bloody fed up with it. You know, it's so much easier to cooperate and solve these problems together rather than, you know, carrying on the sort of exhausting, competition that just goes nowhere.
And I think that's where a lot of people are now, isn't it? They've had enough, but they can't see a way out. And you can actually, the supposed ways out, which will put us back into contemporary news. Brexit is seen as, for some people, a way out of some of this. Donald Trump, his election, for some people, was seen as an alternative to this, a way of doing something differently. Bernie Sanders, on the opposite end of the political scale in the US, he was seen as like a way out. Jeremy Corbyn, Labour leader here in the UK, he's seen as but none of these are actually offering the panacea. They're just manifestations of this frustration, I think, with the status quo.
Well, they are, Greg, and as you'll know from the book, one of the things that we are trying to disabuse people of is the idea that voting in one or other of these people can kind of solve the problem. You know, the difficulty today is that we're living in a globalized world. It doesn't matter who we elect anymore. Whoever we elect to this nation or that will not be able to do, you know, governments do not have the autonomy anymore that we like to think they have. You know, this is what we call in the book, the myth of the sovereign nation. And that's why it actually, you know, we've got to give up on the idea that mummy and daddy politician, if we just vote in the right one, can solve our problems for us. You know, they can't. And that's why we citizens have to do it for them. But we need an organizing framework and process, which is sort of what Simpol is proposing, to allow citizens to take control drive our politicians to, you know, to where we all need to go, which is to some kind of global cooperative agreement under which all of these issues can be dealt with equitably.
Yeah, and I'll just say to people again, if anyone's just thinking communism, they're thinking collectivism, gone mad, they're thinking global government, it's not what you're advocating. I'm no fan of any of that. It's all been tried, maybe not global government, but you know, the global government model has been tried on a smaller scale, and all of these things have been proven to be unsatisfactory or just insanely dysfunctional. So that's not what we're talking about. You're just trying to see a way through this, because the alternative, which I don't think anybody really wants, is more of the same until we annihilate ourselves. And, you know, even doesn't matter how many ivory towers that elite people can build, you know, money won't protect them in the end. Private armies will only do so much. At some point, we're going to get to a point I described there a minute ago where it's just like, okay, enough is enough. And either those people who are in a position to really start doing something about this will do, or they'll just, one way or another, they'll be set aside and other people will step forward and do it. And two perhaps extreme examples of this that spring to mind, one from fiction and one from the real world. Perhaps the most extreme one is probably, you know, people are familiar with post-apocalyptic fiction and the film Mad Max. And I've used this example before, and I said, well, what happens in the original Mad Max trilogy? Okay, you have a world in crisis, energy, economics, environment. You have collapse. We see that in the second film. Men feeding on men. It's a nightmare. Civilization as you and I know it, you know, a decent life, families struggle to hang on by the skin of their teeth in that situation. What happens in the third film? They come out the other end, and what do they end up doing to make a future? they cooperate. They start to they start to build again only when those people that were tearing each other's lungs out, only when they've decided they can't take it anymore, do things start to improve. So
exactly.
Now that's it. We don't want it to come to that, but that's what, you know, that's our, how strong our impulse to actually survive is. The other one, to use a real world example, I remember very well in the 1980s when they started to introduce unleaded petrol. And there was a whole resistance to the first adopter thing. And I clearly remember the adults at the time, some of the men saying, was, you know, men, it would have been then, more like it being in control of which car was bought and what fuel went in it. Oh, that new unleaded, it'll never take off. I'm not getting an unleaded car because it'll just be me. No one else will do it. You know, and, oh, it costs more. You know, no, it's going to, the car will be less powerful. And at some point, something happened and suddenly it was like, oh, you're still using 4-star. Oh, that's odd. Or, oh, I can't buy 4-star anymore. And people just switched over to unleaded. I'm not quite sure what happened, but it wasn't an individual that did that. It was like a societal dynamic. I dare say psychological, and Nick will have something to say about that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, that's right. And you know, what we think is impossible today becomes very, very possible tomorrow. And this is always, you know, this is, you know, I very much sort of see ourselves today, Greg, much as perhaps people were in at the end of the Middle Ages in Europe, when we still had middle aged small states in Germany and Italy and, you know, many other nations. Well, they weren't nations, many parts of Europe. And no doubt, you know, a lot of them were saying to each other, when somebody sort of suggested the idea of a nation state, it's, oh, come on, you must be kidding. You know, this is mad, that will never happen. And, you know, it did happen. It's going to be the same globally. Either we're going to perish and go back to Mad Max, or we're going to have to take globalization seriously and create a global political cooperation that is in no way a world government. It is just merely simultaneous implementation of certain agreed laws and taxes and what have you to legislate globally on the bads that we're all experiencing at the moment.
So just as we bring things to a close for today, John, what has the response been so far? Now, obviously, as we talked about earlier, you know, the simple concept has been around for some time now, but you've obviously been doing some publicity for the book. Maybe some advanced copies have gone out there. What sort of response have you had to this new drive to get the ideas out there compared to how the response has been thus far?
We've had some really good responses, and you'll see some of them from Noam Chomsky and Ken Wilber and other people in the inside cover of the book. You know, we're getting a really good response. And I think that part of that is because of Brexit and Trump. I think until Brexit and Trump happened, people, particularly on the left, were just not really listening to the sort of thing that we're putting forward. But now they are much more ready to listen. It's, you know, we're getting a very good response indeed so far.
Well, just a closing thought from me. I mean, just to be positive here, this is a challenge, undoubtedly. We're facing multiple challenges, but this is an opportunity. And that might sound like a bit of a cliche. People say there's opportunity in every challenge, but really this, I think, medium to long term, what we're looking at here isn't just trying to salvage the remnants of something that was once somewhat good. There's an opportunity here to make something much better. Now, we may not live to see it. Maybe our grandchildren won't live to see it, but that's the trajectory that we're on. I think that we have the chance to seize that opportunity to move to like a new stage of development. I'm not talking, you mentioned earlier, utopia. There will be no utopia. There never has been. There never will be. A utopia is almost as disastrous as a dystopia. But we can remodel many of our systems as we evolve our sense of self and how we see the world. And that's really, as Nick has pointed out, that's crucial. You know, change our thinking, because everything flows from that.
Absolutely. It certainly does. And, you know, you're absolutely right in the way you've laid it out there, Greg. I would only just say that you, having worked with Simpol for some time, that the results we've achieved at the last election, we got about over 600 candidates from all the main parties signed up to Simpol, and the number of citizens that were active in achieving that was actually relatively small. So the great thing about Simpol is you initially think, oh God, it's going to take masses and masses of people to get anything to happen. Well, actually, the leverage power is incredibly strong. It can take relatively few people to make a big result, and that's, you know, that's the beauty of a new way of doing politics and a new way of thinking.
Well, John, and Nick, the book, as you mentioned earlier, it's entitled The Simpol Solution. That's widely available, all the usual outlets. Perhaps you'd like to, John, you'd perhaps like to share a relevant website or websites for listeners, or just any other resources or anything else you'd like to put out there.
Yeah, if you go to the Simpol website, that's simpol.org, you can find a link on the front page there to the book page. And you can find out much more about the book and about what people have said about it and where you can order it and so forth. And you can also, on the Simpol side, of course, you can find out much more about Simpol itself as well. Yeah, and thank you, Greg. It's really been a great pleasure talking to you. And it's really good fun to be able to, you know, talk a little bit at some length about the book and some of the ideas in it. So thanks very much indeed.